Hello, are you ready to conceive, carry and deliver a healthy baby? Welcome to the podcast Ready to Conceive, and I'm your host, Inna Duckworth. I am a fertility expert, and today I've got a very, very, very special guest. I am super excited. And my guest is Sarah Laver. She's an embryologist and nutritionist, and we are both almost completed a super amazing program in fertility support, additional fertility support training. So in that way, we're colleagues, but Sarah's amazing experience, I'd like to know more about what she knows. And Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers?
Yes, thank you very much, Inna. Thank you for that lovely welcome. So I am Sarah Laver. I am the founder of the Embryologist Nutritionist. And I'm a BANT registered nutritionist, a registered nutritional therapist, and my focus has a special area of fertility and IVF support. Now, most nutritionists tend to have their own story. They have a journey that lends them to end up in that particular area of focus. I don't have a particular journey of my own. The reason why I work in fertility support is because I had a previous career, as you kindly mentioned, as a clinical embryologist. So for a period of over about 11 years, I worked in various IVF clinics in the UK, and I was based in the laboratory, handling the egg, sperm, and the development of the embryos and undertaking all the processes that were involved there. So when I decided to retrain as a nutritionist, it seemed a natural progression to move into the fertility arena, because I think my mission, my focus has always been on just wanting to help and support others. I've been driven all my life for that, and it just seemed the natural sort of progression for me to move into the fertility arena.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And you're like, the experience of being an embryologist is absolutely essential here, I think. Now, can you tell me, what do you actually see when you look through the microscope? What does it look like to you?
Yeah, it's when I think back to those days, it was amazing. Being able to see the eggs and the sperm and watch the embryos develop was fantastic. And when we start right back at what the eggs look like, so when we would do the egg collection, we would be assessing the follicular fluid that was drained during the process. And you would see the little kind of circles surrounded by all their nourishing cells called the cumulus cells. So you couldn't see the eggs in real detail at that point because they had all these cells around them. But then when we go back to the laboratory and you take those cells away from the outside of the eggs, then you get a good view of what the egg quality and what the eggs actually look like. And I think it's fair to say that the majority of eggs do look quite similar. They do look quite uniform in their appearance, uniform color, uniform kind of texture. They are enclosed within a shell called the zona pellucida. And sometimes that can look a bit different. So sometimes it might be a little bit thicker. It might be a little bit thinner. And sometimes there are darker patches within the eggs. And one form of these are called refractile bodies. And it's thought that these refractile bodies actually contain fats that have been damaged. They've been oxidized. And this is something that we can talk about a little bit more, but it could be a sign that those eggs have been exposed to a certain level of something called oxidative stress that can happen within the body. And it forms these, at least these little refractile bodies forming. And they can vary in size from being very small to being a little bit larger. But so that can differentiate one egg from another. Sometimes the eggs can look a little bit darker or a bit granular. And sometimes this is normal. It's just the distribution of the different structures within the egg. But if the eggs do look really quite dark, it could be a sign that they're starting to become necrotic and dying off, and they've been damaged either through their development or just through the egg collection. So those are the sort of main differences when we look at the eggs. There sometimes are size differences, but that's more unusual. You can get eggs that we would call giant eggs, there's probably a very technical term for it now, but this was when I going back years. And sometimes that might mean that the egg hasn't got rid of some of its DNA. So normally when you have a mature egg, you have an egg, and within the shell, the zona, there's also a very small little structure called a polar body, which contains half of the DNA. So the egg has obviously only got half the DNA, the other half will come from the sperm. And in order to get that half, it needs to extrude this polar body. And sometimes if that hasn't happened, and from sort of earlier on in the processes as well, you might get a giant egg because the divisions haven't been able to take place. I suppose what else can we tell from looking at the eggs? You can tell the maturity of the egg, because if the eggs are from very smaller follicles, then they will look a little bit smaller, and they are at a stage called a germinal vesicle. And what we're wanting to see is we're wanting to see a mature egg when it's extruded that polar body. So we're able to see that down the microscope as well.
Well, that's amazing. There's three topics straight away from here. One is the oxidative stress. So this is the one we're talking about, like that we are kind of exposed through food, ecology, and lifestyle, pollutants, natural toxins, and chemical toxins. So what does it mean if someone's got these batches, bodies? Does it mean that the egg is not to be used, or like not to process into embryo? What's the opinion, general opinion?
You can get differing sizes of the refractile bodies. And if they're quite small, they don't appear to have the same detrimental effect on the embryo quality and implantation as when they get a little bit bigger. When the size of them increases, then their effect on successful implantation and pregnancy would decrease. And you would choose embryos, ideally, that have come from eggs that didn't contain refractile bodies.
Okay.
So as much as possible, you would choose against them.
Well, yeah, that would be good if you already worked as nutritionist and at the moment when you were an embryologist, to try to link with the lifestyle of this particular woman that came, and those egg owner, if you like, or egg. But the other question I've got is about the maturity of the eggs. So most women would have some medication to produce more eggs, so that at one procedure more eggs can be collected and preserved, is frozen or made into embryos. So what would affect this maturation? Can nutritionally be supported? Can this maturation be nutritionally supported?
I think by a large impact would be their drug regime, mm-hmm. and the way that they are stimulated. That will play a huge role in ensuring that the follicles are growing to the right size, because the more mature eggs come from the larger follicles. So to ensure that a cohort of good sized follicles are developing, that's the drugs do come into a large part. But from a nutritional perspective, ensuring a nutrient dense diet that is supportive of lots of nutrients that really work for optimal oocyte development and egg development, because that's obviously, as a woman, we're born with all of our eggs from day zero, and the process from them being dormant in our ovaries takes about a year, where they click back onto their development and they carry on developing. The final stage is about 3 months, and this is where the eggs are really finishing off their development. And so focusing on a nutrient-dense diet with appropriate supplementation for those 3 months is vital. And for sort of many processes with eggs and with sperm, a lot of energy is required. And this energy is produced and released from the mitochondria that are contained within the eggs and within the sperm. And so ensuring that the mitochondrial health is optimum and being supported, then that's really important as well.
So for those who will be listening, about like, can you just touch upon a bit more about mitochondrial health and its link to oxidative stress? and what's kind of, if you just, if you'd like to just sort of clarify a bit more, what does it mean, mitochondrial health?
Yes, so the mitochondria are known as the sort of powerhouses of our cells. They use the foods that we eat, the nutrients that we get from the foods that we eat, and they convert them. And in that conversion, energy is released. And that energy is then used to power many other processes and functions within our body. As a byproduct of that release of energy, there are little molecules called reactive oxygen species that are released. Mm-hmm. And what these want to do, they're quite unstable. So it's like imagining they want to steal something from a cell in your body to make themselves more stable. And by doing that, they can then make other cells unstable. And mm-hmm. so that causes something called oxidative stress, which can impact on a lot of different functions and parts of our cells. And so ensuring that a normal level of that is present in our bodies, it's going on all the time, but our bodies are very clever and they make something to counteract it. And that's called antioxidants. So mm-hmm. our bodies produce antioxidants to help balance that out. And we also get antioxidants from our diet. Mm-hmm. And so ensuring that nutritionally we are eating a very good balanced diet with lots of different colors from the fruits and vegetables, those different colors all provide different antioxidant properties. So they're going to help minimize any oxidative stress, which then supports the structure and the integrity of all of our body's cells. And those cells obviously include our egg cells and our sperm cells.
Yeah, so just like, is this understanding that before kind of procreation, the body wants to be nourished itself? So you need to really kind of feed yourself, and then there will be the surplus is kind of going for procreation. That's why when we are super stressed, it's quite like more difficult to get to fertility topics. Okay. Well, the next big question I've got is about sperm health. We talk less about it, and yes, as far as like we have been doing the work together, and like, I mean, in terms of our program, we know now that the importance of sperm health. Can you tell, like, and it's just an opening topic, because like even a couple of years ago, talking about male fertility wasn't that popular, if you like, or not that open. And we are just being part of this pioneering cohort where you need to work with both, with a female and male partner, and or so. Can you tell us what do you see when you look at a sperm? What are, it's all the same, but the other side of the story, please.
Yeah, of course. And so, yeah, you're very right that the male side of things has been largely ignored for a long, long period of time, and it's now being realised how much male fertility and infertility can impact on the situation. And it's also that there might not be anything very obvious, but it's trying to optimize that male fertility. So when we analyze a sperm sample, we carry out something called a semen analysis. The male partner has produced a sample by masturbation, and we then look at the sample down a microscope to see how many sperm there are, how those sperm are moving, what the sperm look like, and if there's anything else within the sample that is worthy of note. So we use a set of guidelines which have a lower reference range of when a sample is classed as normal. And these are generated by the WHO, the World Health Organization. And so that is like a guideline for when we can say a sample is normal, in inverted commas, or a sample is subnormal. And we're looking therefore at the concentration, so how many sperm are present in a milliliter of that sample. And then when you know the volume of the sample, you look at how many sperm are present in that sample in total. You're looking at the percentage of them that are moving and have motility. And we also grade that motility as whether it is progressive. So are the sperm actually swimming in one direction? Or sometimes sperm might be going around in circles and just not going anywhere, not actually progressing in a forward manner. So it's really important to to assess how the sperm are moving, not just are they moving or are they not. And morphology is the shape of the sperm. And that is very important as well, because there are different parts of the sperm, and all of those different parts of the sperm can look different and therefore could impact on that sperm's ability to fertilize an egg, to reach the egg or to fertilize the egg. So those are the three main aspects on a semen analysis that we look for. There are other factors that are checked, like the pH of the sample, whether there are any other cells that are present, which might be an indication of an infection. But those are the main ones. I don't know if you want me to talk about...
I'd like you to tell us about the three parts of the actual spermatozoa, please. Like, how what are they kind of doing? What is that? I mean, yeah. I'm fascinated by this, and I'd like to get more of your expertise here.
Brilliant. So the sperm is essentially formed of three major elements. You have the sperm head, you have the midpiece, which is like a connecting piece, and you have the sperm tail. So the midpiece is essentially connecting the head to the tail, but it has a very important role as well. The sperm head is where the DNA, the genetic material, is held. So that is held within the sperm head. And across the top of the sperm head is something called an acrosome. It's like a cap, you could describe it as. And that cap is filled with enzymes. And so in natural procreation, what would happen when the sperm meets the egg is there's a process that happens within the sperm that allows that cap to burst open and the enzymes are released. And those enzymes help that sperm to get through to bind with the egg. So that is a very important part. And sometimes you can see sperm, it's more rare, but you can see sperm in a semen analysis which don't have that cap at all on the sperm head. And that is a case called globozoospermia. And those sperm don't have those enzymes at all. And in that case, they would never be able to fertilize an egg naturally. But that is more rare to see that. So that's the sperm head. The midpiece, the connecting element, that is really important because it contains the mitochondria. So I can't remember the exact statistic here, but there was a figure of, in sort of comparative human terms, how far the sperm have to swim to get to the egg in natural procreation. And it's a long, long way. And so they need a lot of energy to do that swimming. And so the midpiece is full of mitochondria to produce that energy to aid the sperm to swim. And so you want that midpiece to, first of all, be present and not absent. And you want the mitochondria, again, like we talked about with the egg health, you want the mitochondria to be healthy and not damaged. And then the sperm tail is the longest part of the sperm. And this main function is to obviously project the sperm, to allow it to swim so that it can reach the egg. And you can get abnormalities in all those three different areas. You can get sperm with two or even more than two tails. You can get sperm with thicker tails, shorter tails. You can get very large array of abnormalities in shape of head. And obviously, if the head is misshapen, that might impact the sperm's ability to move. It might impact the sperm's ability to bind and fertilize the egg. And obviously, if there are abnormalities with the midpiece, then that might affect the sperm's ability to have that energy to swim to the egg. And in IVF, there are, in normal standard IVF, obviously, the sperm do still need to do a bit of swimming to get to the egg. If there are problems with the shape of the sperm, then a procedure called ICSI might be recommended, where you're manually injecting the sperm into the egg if there is the feeling that the sperm wouldn't be able to do that themselves. So yeah, that's how the morphology can affect.
That's really, really interesting. So when we get a good sperm test, because not all the sperm tests, but just saying that before you ideally order any tests, you start working with a practitioner who can help you choose the right test for you, because like as a cohort of we have seen tests where there's just no not enough information. So somebody's paid for a test a test came in this like sort of, you know, our sort of 21st century kind of iconography, but there is no actual information there. Whilst some tests which come just like a plain Excel tables, they've got all the information you need. So before you venture into ordering any tests, I'd say that have somebody on your side who can help you choose the right test for you. Now, the point I'm trying to make and ask Sarah about is, we have seen this test where you've got like a percentage of, so we've got a percentage of sperm that is actually viable. And then you've got the breakdown that there is a percentage of head damage, meat kind of body damage, and the tail damage. And just correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah. So do you understand correctly that DNA health, we can work with nutritionally to improve DNA health and thus like reduce this head, kind of head misshapen, if you like. And then we can work on mitochondrial health, just like we've discussed for the egg. And can we do something for the tail as well? And what about the cap? Do you see the cap damage in a normal sperm test, or you would need to be in the IVF process? How does it work?
I'll just clarify with the DNA in the head. So when you see a sperm with a misshapen head, there's a head defect, it's not telling you anything about the DNA. We can't assess the DNA. It's just that sperm may not be able to bind to the egg as easily if its head is misshapen, but it doesn't actually tell you anything about the DNA within the head. That's something that you can investigate through a different sperm test called a DNA fragmentation test. Okay. You can look at whether the DNA has become damaged. But the different abnormalities in shape that you can see, they can be supported through a nutrient-dense diet, because the process of spermatogenesis, which is the making, the production and the maturation of the sperm, takes, again, it's about 72 days. It's around 2 to 3 months. And whilst this process is taking place, it can be affected by oxidative stress. It can be affected by poor diet, by stress, by environmental effects, like you've mentioned. And through supporting the diet with lots of nutrients, because there are various nutrients that are required to carry out those processes. And by supporting it with a great diet that has lots of those antioxidants, that would help to reduce any tail defects or any defects in the shape of the sperm. You may not be able to go from having, you know, a certain degree of abnormal shapes to zero. It's never going to be perfect. It's very, very normal, because a normal cutoff is 4% of normal forms. So that's with the majority of sperm being abnormal in shape. 96% of sperm can look abnormal and the sample is still classed as normal. So it is usual to see abnormally shaped sperm. But by bringing in some nutrients and some nutritionally focused approaches, improving the diet, you may be able to make an impact and improve the morphology of sample.
Okay, so that is really, like, this is all fascinating. I'd like to kind of strengthen this very important point. So, because when there, say, for example, there's an infertility situation, so there's like a sort of the pregnancy doesn't occur, like, let's call it in a more sort of a supportive way. So the pregnancy doesn't occur, and we have got a sperm test which has got like normal sort of parameter on morphology. And until we do the DNA fragmentation test, we cannot 100% say that this genetic material is suitable. That's kind of, is it the situation, would you say? Because normally most of the work is carried out with a woman, and like the men just do sperm test, maybe blood test at best, and there is like, oh, morphology is fine, off you go. And then all the work, sort of 90% of the efforts go to a woman. But I'd like to kind of focus on this DNA fragmentation a little bit more, if you could something to add.
Yeah. I mean, the DNA fragmentation, so that this test is in relation to whether the DNA has been damaged through processes like oxidative stress. And it isn't something that you can, like, as you rightly said, you can't tell this by looking at a sample from a seam analysis. It definitely is something that is often recommended to investigate to assess the level of fragmentation within that sample, because that then may highlight an area where further nutritional or supplemental support would be beneficial. It would just highlight if there was a higher degree of potential damage taking place to those sperm.
Okay. So what my point being, I mean, this is very, my point being that, are you ready to really give it all to get this baby? You know, because like if it's a partnership, in my opinion, and if you stop at just a semen test and don't look further, I think there should be an openness and understanding that actually there's a huge chunk of work that still can be done to kind of to support like this, to support fertility. That's what I wanted to say here. I had another question, but we sort of covered it a bit, but I'd still ask it so that you can kind of elaborate a bit more that. So when I was asking you previously, like, can you say, so you would personally, as an embryologist, you would look at the sperm, you would look at the egg, and then you would support them creating an embryo? How would that work? Is it the procedure where they just swim normally in a petri dish, or is it a needle? How does it work?
Yeah, so that very much depends on the quality of the sperm sample. That can be the major dictating factor as to whether you do standard IVF. And standard IVF means that you have an egg in a droplet of culture media and you add a particular volume of prepared sperm sample to that drop. And then the sperm have to still do a little bit of swimming to get to the egg. It's not a huge distance, but they still have to do a bit of swimming. So there is still some self-selection there going on of which sperm is going to fertilize the egg. And the quality of the sperm sample would dictate whether that happens, or if there wasn't very many sperms, if the concentration was very, very low, if the motility was very poor, if the morphology, the shape of the sperm was very poor, then you may be advised to have a procedure called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is where the embryologist uses a different microscope and selects individual sperm, which they then inject into the eggs. And after either of those procedures, the IVF, they are just left overnight and they're checked for fertilization the next day. ICSI, again, once the ICSI procedure is done, the eggs are put back into the incubator and they're left to be checked the next day.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where like, that's mind-blowing, all of this. Like, I wanted to ask you here, like, the quality of the embryo, do you see like direct translation from the quality of the egg to the quality of the embryo? How does it work?
Yeah, as I sort of said at the beginning, a lot of eggs look very similar. If you had an egg that was very, very dark, you may see the cells where you would see the cells of the embryo also looking quite dark, because that it's just the one cell that keeps splitting. So the way that it appears would go through. If there was an element, like we talked about, the refractile body, if it was very small, that would then end up just being in one of the cells of the embryo as it goes, because as the one large cell splits into two and then it splits into four, it splits into eight, obviously that refractile body is only going to be in one part of that. Which is why when the refractile body is very small, it doesn't have as much of an impact, because the rest of the embryo doesn't have any. So it kind of fills it out. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yes, it does. But would it before you go further, would it mean theoretically, I don't know if there's any research on that refractile body being in that one cell will transfer into some kind of innate weakness in a specific like area? Metabolically later, or it will be compensated?
I don't know enough. I don't know if the data is there. I know that you ideally would choose an embryo that hasn't had refractile bodies. It's more, I think, from the point of view that it wouldn't have the same chance of implanting and going on to a pregnancy. But the quality of eggs, when we say the word quality, it's used to describe what we can subjectively see. We can't assess the quality from the point of DNA. So we don't know what's going on with the DNA of the egg. There's no way of us, just by looking down a microscope, knowing that. Mm-hmm. So when embryologists talk about the quality of something, it is our subjective view of how neatly the embryo has divided. So when the cells have split, how neatly have they done that? Is there something called fragmentation within the embryo, where one of the cells might have broken up into lots of little pieces? But the quality from the point of view of DNA and how good the DNA is not something that we can assess down the microscope unless the embryo is undergoes a process called biopsy, where you might do pre-implantation genetic screening to look at the actual chromosomes of that embryo. Then you're able to assess whether there is the right number of chromosomes there, and that gives you an idea of the quality. But just by looking down the microscope, we're not able to tell that.
Would you say, how often is this procedure performed, or would you want it to be done more often? Like, or is there some medical predisposition to do that? Is it too damaging?
The techniques for biopsy have improved so much since when I was working in the laboratory. They've come on a lot. And biopsy is now done at the blastocyst stage, so where the embryo is on about day 5 and it's very developed. Biopsy can be done if there is a particular genetic condition within the family that you're wanting to screen the embryos for, something like cystic fibrosis. Then that's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. If you're screening for something called aneuploidy, which is where you're checking the number of chromosomes to make sure that there's the correct number of chromosomes present, because when there is an imbalance, that's when the embryo may not be able to implant and develop onto a healthy pregnancy, or there could be conditions such as trisomy 21 and Down syndrome. That is an example of an aneuploidy. The HFVA, who is the regulatory body for IVF clinics, has a list of add-ons, which are extra procedures that you can do on top of the IVF and the ICSI that may have benefits. And the biopsy, the aneuploidy screening, is one of these add-ons. And what the HFVA do is they have a traffic light system. So they grade something as red, amber, or green, dependent on the amount of evidence that is there backing up that process. And I believe at the moment the aneuploidy screening is at an amber rating. So the HFVA don't say this is, yes, it's brilliant, there's lots of evidence behind it. And the reason being for that, in my understanding, is that aneuploidy screening won't increase everyone's chances. So if you have someone that comes through who's 28 years old and has got blocked tubes, and that's why they're having IVF, and they have IVF, it's probably not going to benefit them to have the aneuploidy screening done. Where it does appear to benefit is in women who are slightly older, who are in their late 30s, 40s, where there is a higher chance of these chromosomal errors occurring. For that targeted group, or people that have potentially had a number of failed cycles where there's been no implantation or an early miscarriage, for those people, potentially the aneuploidy screening may have benefits. But because it's not beneficial across the board, and the evidence shows that, it's not green-lighted by the HFA. So it's obviously allowed, and it's carried out by many, many clinics in the UK and abroad, but it's more beneficial to certain subsets of IVF patients.
Okay, yes. I totally understand that this idea of individual, of deciding case by case, but I also think it's very important that people know and explore these opportunities as part of their IVF process. And I just wanted to ask you, like, have you got any kind of advice or any suggestion or any kind of direction for people to, when they're thinking about IVF, what do you think they should take into consideration?
I think first and foremost, it's being comfortable with the clinic. That for me, I think that would be really important. Stress, as I'm sure you know, and your listeners know, stress can, it is very evident for those who are going down a fertility journey. And it potentially may impact their fertility further. So we want to try and manage stress levels as much as possible. And by somebody being comfortable with an IVF clinic and feeling that they can get hold of people when they need to, then that is, for me, a real plus. And that's what people should be looking for, where they can feel a connection. Location is, again, very important, because for a lot of people, if they go for IVF, they will have to have regular scans. So it's ensuring that they're going to be able to get to that clinic easily enough, or a satellite clinic if they work through different satellite clinics. And to check their success rates, so you can go on the HFEA website and you can look at the different success rates of the clinics, and they are compared to the national average. So you can see how those clinics compare as well. So by looking at those and considering those different factors, that's what I would recommend.
Well, that's amazing. Look, I can ask you 100 more questions, but I wanted to ask you to tell our listeners how they can work with you. Is anything interesting in coming for them from your, how they can work with you? Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been lovely talking to you as well. I work with clients on a one-on-one basis. And if anyone was interested to do that, then I work with a minimum of a 3-month package, because I feel that is a minimum amount of time to really instill positive changes. And people can find me on my website is www.theembryologistnutritionist.co.uk, and they can book in for a free call through there, or through my social media channels on Instagram and TikTok, where I'm found as The Embryologist Nutritionist. And I've also got a online group course, which is actually starting on Monday. And this is the Egg and Sperm Health Signature Program. So this is very much focused on what we've talked about today. It's focusing on getting those foundations in place that are going to support the health of your egg and sperm. We cover things like nutrition from a general perspective, what is great to include, what things maybe should someone be avoiding within their diet. I cover restrictive diets. Should everyone be gluten-free? Are there things to consider if someone's gluten-free or dairy-free or following a vegetarian diet? We look at specific nutrients that have important roles in fertility. And then we also cover lifestyle elements, mindset, looking at stress, but also practically how to manage it. So I'm very much about not just educating, but giving practical advice as well, so someone can go away and make changes. And I cover environmental toxins, their impact, and then I will finish off on that course, just the next steps that someone might take, what further things might they want to investigate to support their fertility journey. So yes, that course starts on Monday. And again, you can find more information about that on my website.
There'll be details under this episode as well.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So that people can find you. Good. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I think the course sounds really, really good. And given that your expertise in this sort of very particular area of sperm and egg health, I think that's the best way people can go about it. All right. Anything you'd like to say, like as a sort of sharing vision, anything before we...
Thank you. I think it's amazing that you have this podcast and you're sharing your knowledge and educating people. And I think that people are beginning to know more and understand more now about the impact that nutrition and lifestyle changes can have on their fertility. But I do think that people need to understand that these things do take a bit of time to take place. It's not just if they change what they're eating this week, then next week things are going to be much better. It does take some time. So people do need to be focusing on these things for a number of months to then be able to notice the effect later down the line.
Yes. And I completely agree with you that. And I'd probably want to kind of finish this episode with something that even if you need IVF, okay, it does not cancel out this preparation, because as you have just heard from Sarah, that the quality of the egg, yes, the drugs will help you have more eggs. That's what the drugs will help you. But what goes in that eggs come from the work that you have done before that, like the food, the nutritional, like just nutritional approaches, supplements, some other work that can be done and needed and is decided between you and your practitioner that like you chose to work with. And same is about sperm, you know. So as you heard, Sarah, yes, that it can be helped, that the sperm can be placed in the egg or like, you know, so we have learned how to do that. But again, the quality of this sperm and the quality of this egg is something that you bring to the party. And it's not something that can be, and there's a third part, which is implantation part, which is your health of your vaginal health, if you like. And this is where, as far as I know, not many IVF clinics actually do advanced vaginal swabs like we do, for example. And like, for example, if we know that the environment, so we've got three elements here, literally, it's just like humans, you've got a female, a male and a house, you know, so the quality of egg is your female input, quality of sperm is male, and then the house, which has been the womb and the for implantation, we must make sure that the environment is right, that there is no inflammation, there is no BV, there is no other sort of unhealthy microbiome there, and there is plenty of healthy lactobacillus species there, and all of that is not covered by any IVF program. A very few IVF program in this country, well, maybe in others, are just starting taking nutritional therapists on board and other holistic practitioners to cover this work. So just be prepared that you still need to do your homework before you go for IVF, just to avoid, to minimize disappointment when the fertilization or the implantation didn't happen. Or I find my particular role is minimizing miscarriages, because the impact of the dramatic, the sort of the grief and the pain and all of that can be minimized, the risk of that can be minimized by doing this homework that we talked about.
Yeah. Hey, hey.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Sarah. It's been amazing. I hope to see you again when the podcast will be like with some thousands of listeners. Mm-hmm. I'd love to call you again. Thank you very much. And you listeners and viewers, because this episode will go on YouTube as well, do leave your questions either under the as comments or just address them to Sarah if you'd like to. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
And thank you, Wynne. It's been lovely.
Let me stop recording now. Okay.